This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. More dangerous warming methane is pouring into the atmosphere. Later in this hour, expert Ewan Nisbet tells us where it is coming from, and no, not from the Arctic. There is far more carbon stored in the soil of this planet than in its atmosphere. If soil organisms release that as carbon dioxide, faster and faster as the climate warms, we may not be able to stop it. Or can we? Our guest, Dr. Thomas Crowther, is an assistant professor of global ecosystem ecology at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. He directs the Crowther Lab. Thomas is also a Marie Curie Fellow at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. Our last interview on Radio EcoShock was in December 2016, and he's been busy since. If you care about life, this is a must-listen guest.
Radio EcoShock.
Thomas Crowther, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, Thomas, I realize you have some planet-scale solutions to help stave off the worst of climate change, but first let me ask about carbon, warming, and the Arctic. Is the Earth losing more carbon from the soil into the atmosphere?
It's a very good and important question. Essentially, there's an ongoing debate among scientists about whether the Earth's surface is going to continue to absorb some of the human emissions that we've been producing over the last 100 years. And a growing body of evidence is suggesting that that process is stopping in plants, and in fact, the soils might in fact be becoming a source of carbon. As we warm the planet, the activity of microorganisms in the soil starts to speed up, and this could actually increase losses of carbon into the atmosphere, which could accelerate the rate of climate change.
Well, you've brought up another key question, which is, does global warming impact the rate or amount of carbon loss from the soil?
This is ultimately one of the biggest questions of ecosystem ecologists. And I think, at least in our lab, we're taking a very sort of global approach, a holistic global approach to consider the soils and the plants. And it suggests that when you take all of these ecosystems in combination, it does suggest that, yeah, we're starting to get accelerated losses of carbon into the atmosphere.
At the 2019 annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, it was in Washington this February, you presented a chart that shows where carbon is buried under the soil. And I found it very surprising to see what part of the Earth has the biggest depository of carbon buried down there. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Essentially, we've always focused on the tropics for much of our climate change research because these are the areas where there's huge trees and huge carbon storage in the forest. But what we actually find when we look below the surface is actually that the vast, vast majority of the world's carbon is actually stored in the high-latitude parts of the world, like the Arctic and subarctic regions. And these store a huge amount of carbon for a very simple reason. It's cold up there, and those cold conditions slow down the activity of the microorganisms in the soil. And when their activity is slowed down, they don't respire as much. And that slowed down respiration means that when carbon goes in, it stays in there for a long, long time, thousands of years, and it builds up to a huge extent. And that carbon storage in those soils is one of the biggest and most important stocks of carbon on our planet.
But it's still surprising because so little vegetation grows up there at this time compared to something like the Amazon, which is just a carbon storehouse. How could it all be up in the Arctic like that?
It's a very good question. It's all about the balance between these two very simple processes. Photosynthesis is the uptake of carbon by plants, and respiration is the release of carbon back into the atmosphere. And what we find is actually that respiration is a lot more temperature sensitive than photosynthesis. And what that means is when it's warm, like in the tropics, photosynthesis is huge and plants are taking up loads and loads of carbon. But respiration is even higher. So when the leaves fall and when that plant carbon goes into the soil, the activity of those microorganisms in the soil is so high that they just spew the carbon back into the atmosphere in most parts of the tropics. That I would put a caveat that that doesn't happen in wetlands, which are very anaerobic, and so that you can build up a lot of soil carbon there. But in most of the tropics, you see this huge loss of carbon into the atmosphere from the soils. In contrast, when we go down into the cold areas, photosynthesis is very low. As you said, plants are tiny, they're taking up a small amount of carbon, but respiration is even lower. So even though a very small drip of carbon is coming into those ecosystems, it's not leaving because the microorganisms in the soil are so cold and they're so slow that carbon just stays there for thousands of years and builds up gradually over time.
Is there enough carbon held now in the Arctic and subarctic to actually affect our future climate if it starts to become released at a greater rate?
I would stress with all urgency that yes, the answer is overwhelmingly yes. The amount of carbon stored in those high latitudes is huge, many times more than all of the plant vegetation in total. And if we're going to start warming our planet to an extent that those microorganisms start respiring at a faster and faster rate, then those huge carbon stocks become very, very vulnerable. So managing those ecosystems and trying to keep temperatures cool, keep plants on those soils, managing them effectively, reducing tillage and damage could be maybe one of our most effective strategies to minimize the impacts of climate change.
In an interview with David Gadsden, you said there are probably more animals in the Arctic than in the tropics. Now, that's just preposterous. How could that be?
Yeah, it sounds crazy, but our initial suggestions are pointing in that direction. I should stress that the exact information on this topic has just been accepted for publication, and I'll be able to give you the exact details on that information when it comes out in the journal. But we can point towards suggesting that, yes, in fact, most of the world's animals exist below the soil in the form of these tiny little nematode worms. Almost four out of every five animals on the planet is a nematode worm. And these are some of the microorganisms that exist in those huge soil carbon stocks in the high latitude regions. And remember, these go all the way from the Arctic, you know, down to like the UK, down to halfway through North America. This is the whole Arctic and subarctic area. And these are teeming with organisms. And in fact, when we go further down into the tropics, the soil carbon storage is so small there, it's not enough to support a huge amount of those organisms. So it may in fact be the case that, yes, those high latitude areas are where most of the world's life is.
And some of this knowledge comes from the first global map of life under the soil developed by your lab?
That's it, yeah. So our lab's trying to sort of do science with a slightly different approach. Rather than focusing purely on satellites, which have been transformative in our understanding of, you know, the global scale ecosystems, what we do now is we collect thousands and thousands and thousands of data points, which can allow us to see below the canopy surface. So we can see information about the trees and also about the soil organisms. And when we use artificial intelligence and machine learning, we can really get a good picture of the entire global ecosystem below that surface.
Thomas Crowther, tell us about the Global Soil Biodiversity Initiative. What is that?
Okay, so this is an initiative that was set up several years ago by a lady called Diana Wall, who's a fantastic soil ecologist in the U.S., and she wanted ultimately to connect as many soil ecologists around the world as possible for one simple reason. We've got an amazing idea about the global distribution of plants, but almost no understanding about the global understanding of these below-ground organisms that are so critical for understanding our biosphere and biogeochemistry and the climate and soil fertility. And by connecting those people, she was hoping that we might ultimately be able to combine forces and bring all of our ideas together. Now, what we've done in our lab is rather than just combining the people, we've used that network of people to combine as much data as we can. And so now we're launching our Global Soil Biodiversity Initiative data set, which essentially has a lot of the information that's been collected by those thousands of people around the world to generate that global perspective of the below-ground world that's going to change our understanding of biogeochemistry.
And we know the Arctic is warming faster than pretty well anywhere on the planet. Now, I'm trying to picture what happens in that Arctic and subarctic soil. Does that wake up a lot more life? Does it start that little factory that releases carbon and methane?
That's exactly the fear, yes. As you know, those huge carbon stores only happen there because it's cold. When we alleviate that cold, when we warm the temperatures, those organisms start to speed up their activity, and that speeding up means respiratory losses of carbon into the atmosphere. And in fact, last year we showed that we can actually quantify these losses at a global scale, and we approximate that that's at the moment in the order of about 1.5 gigatons of carbon per year. So by 2050, we're looking at an extra 12 to 17% acceleration of climate change. And in fact, it's equivalent to having another industrialized country the size of the United States on the planet, really.
And that's by 2050.
Exactly.
Wow.
No, I mean, this is an annual loss. The 1.5 gigatons is every other year.
So if we heat up, say, 3 or 4 degrees above pre-industrial by the end of the century, which more scientists are starting to suggest here on Radio EcoShock, what does that do to the kind of carbon loss calculations and the extra warming coming out of that new carbon into the atmosphere?
From our understanding that we have at the moment, it suggests that that's only going to speed up those losses to a great extent. And given the huge, huge amounts of carbon in those high-latitude soils, I don't think it's going to be slowing down anytime soon, unfortunately, unless humans intervene, I should say.
Yes, okay. Well, that sounds like a dangerous positive feedback loop, though, because, I mean, as these organisms start releasing more carbon, the carbon becomes greenhouse gases, which warms up the ground down below more, and then more activity, that could be a dangerous chain.
Yeah, that's exactly the concern. Yes, once we start off biological feedbacks like this, they then accentuate themselves. It's like a rolling cycle, you know, the soil carbon loss increases, causing more warming, which causes the soil carbon loss to increase more, which causes more warming. And yeah, the concern is that these things might accelerate to a great extent.
And because it's a natural system, we can't just pass a law or make regulations to make it stop.
Quite exactly, yeah. So what we really need is to be proactive and get moving now, to be able to minimize those increases in temperature as early as we can so that we can prevent setting off these huge global-scale feedbacks.
You are listening to Dr. Thomas Crowe, the Assistant Professor of Global Ecosystem Ecology at ETH Zurich. This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. Our second adventure, Thomas, goes into your projects, and it starts by asking how many trees there are on Earth. It sounds like maybe a simple question or maybe an impossible question. In fact, it seemed impossible before you tackled it. What did you find, and how did you do it?
It is a fascinating question because I started this a few years ago when I was connected by a friend who worked for an organization called Plant for the Planet, and they were running the UN Billion Tree Campaign. They were planning to plant a billion trees to offset climate change, capture loads of carbon in the trees. But they didn't know how many trees there were to start with. And in fact, there was a previous estimate of about 400 billion trees on the planet. So that's the information they used to make those targets. But after a little bit of back-of-the-envelope calculations, we realized that that number is actually way off. And in fact, no one had done a really robust census of the world's trees. And by doing so, by collecting, again, data from thousands and thousands, in fact, millions of locations around the world, we could get a really good picture on how the numbers of trees vary across the globe. And in fact, that showed us that the Earth stores just over 3 trillion trees.
Wow, you're talking about almost like stars in the sky, 3 trillion. That's quite interesting. Are we losing or gaining trees on this planet?
It's interesting you should make the analogy with stars in the sky because literally there are more trees on our planet than there are stars in our galaxy, which is quite an incredible feat. But the concern is ultimately that we are, good evidence suggests that we are in fact losing trees. Now, plenty of research suggests that in fact in many parts of the world we're seeing greening. So satellites are picking up more and more and more greening of certain ecosystems. And that's often in the high-latitude parts of the world where forests didn't previously exist. As we warm the planet, trees sort of encroach into those ecosystems. But what we're finding is that the small amount of extra trees, tiny extra trees that we're getting in those high-latitude areas is unfortunately not enough to offset the huge amount of losses that we see in the low-latitude, you know, tropical areas as a result of deforestation and land use change.
Well, just now we talked about investigating life in the soil. How does that relate to the life of forests?
These things are so intrinsically linked. Absolutely, a healthy soil is critical if we're going to be able to build a healthy forest. And both of them are undoubtedly necessary for each other. It's funny, as a scientist who works both on soil and vegetation, I often get questions about one topic or the other. And in fact, It's an incredibly connected, holistic system, and having that holistic approach is definitely the best strategy for management in both directions. So soil people ask me, how do we manage our soils? And I say, generally, you know, there's different strategies around the world, but one of the best strategies is, you can always say, increasing plant cover is usually a good thing, and minimizing disturbance is a good thing. The same questions are asked to me of forest people, and I say, improve the soils, support the soils, then the trees can be supported. So it's, they really, healthy soils require healthy vegetation and vice versa.
And you claim to have identified long disappeared forests. How could you do that?
I should state that that's not parts of the world that weren't previously known to man. What we've done is instead begin to understand the full scale of the world's forests. So while satellites could say, okay, this is an area of trees, they vastly underestimated how many trees existed in those areas and how many new trees could be supported in different parts of the world. So it's really not so much identifying new forests as identifying the scale of our forests. And that transforms our understanding of how we manage them in the fight against climate change.
And you claim we could grow another 1.2 trillion new trees. Where could these be planted, and do we have to give up croplands or city space to do it?
No, that is a very good point. We evaluated where on the planet trees could exist using the same sort of approach that we did to evaluate where they do exist. And you're right, we found that, in fact, outside of the world's forests and outside of the world's urban areas and outside of the world's agricultural areas where they are today, there's room for an additional 1.2 trillion new trees. And as a result of that kind of information, the UN's Billion Tree Campaign has now been scaled up to the Trillion Tree Campaign. And the exciting thing is, I was concerned about giving them this information because I thought it might undermine their efforts. But instead, with the new updated scientific information, they took this in such a positive light. And instead of moping around, they've stepped up their efforts and they know their new targets. And already in the last couple of years, they've restored 17 billion new trees, proving that global scale restoration is undoubtedly possible.
Tell us about the Plant for the Planet initiative.
This is a group of essentially children advocates. It's a youth-led organization with 70,000 members all across the world going around and talking to people and promoting global forest restoration and its potential to offset climate change. And the beauty of it is they don't just do that with the most effective, up-to-date scientific information, but it's children, and they're inspiring people across the globe to really get involved in tree planting. And one of their mottos that I really like is the simple statement of stop talking and start planting. And I find myself eternally embroiled in debates about whether tree restoration is the most important or cutting carbon emissions are the most important. And these debates are not useful. Essentially, we are all in agreement that we must minimize atmospheric carbon. Global forest restoration is undoubtedly one of the best strategies we have for doing that, so they just go out there and act. And if people want to get involved in that mission, they are incredibly keen for others to get on board, and they're growing at a great rate.
Could you give us one example of a place where we could install a new forest?
Literally everywhere across the globe, there are forests that could be restored. Now, where our science is trying to focus on is trying to understand which parts of the world are the most important for them to be able to allocate those resources. So in some parts of the world, you know, like the high-latitude boreal forests, planting a forest can actually warm the planet slightly. Of course, it's still better for biodiversity and all the services they provide, but there can be a warming effect because whereas those ecosystems were previously covered in snow, now trees would actually absorb a lot of the sun's light and have a slight warming impact. Whereas often in the low latitudes, in the tropical forests, as you mentioned, those huge carbon stocks in the vegetation have the potential to offset a huge amount of anthropogenic emissions. So we can start to target which are the best locations for them to be able to prioritize their restoration.
Well, suppose we mount a gigantic worldwide program to plant a trillion new trees with the UN, with the kids, with local citizen groups, with some of my listeners, and we do it in part to save the climate. Could it help save the climate?
Our research is providing more and more and more evidence that not only is such a global initiative possible, but it undoubtedly could have a massive impact on the climate. Unfortunately, I'm not able to give you the exact numbers because the paper that we've recently completed is currently in review in a high-impact journal. But when that paper is finally completed, we'll be able to give the exact numbers on how much carbon could potentially be stored in those forests. And what I can confirm is that that value places global forest restoration way above all of the other existing climate change solutions listed. So this simple act of just connecting with the land and planting a few trees, if we all engaged in it, it undoubtedly has the potential to offset a massive chunk of anthropogenic emissions.
Well, lately news came out that the boreal forest stretching across the northern lands has become a net source of carbon instead of the carbon sink we assumed. And I think part of that may have to do with wildfires. I'm not sure. Does that match your findings?
It does, in fact, and that's partly because of wildfires and increased incidence of wildfires, but also because although we are seeing increased growth of trees, as I mentioned earlier, as the climate warms, the soil below those trees is getting warmer, and the microorganisms are starting to respire more rapidly. And so even though trees are taking up more carbon, the soils are actually emitting even more than the trees are taking up. And again, that's that positive climate change feedback that could really accelerate climate change. It's a big concern.
Environmentalists have long claimed that replanting monocultures, like a single commercial tree species after logging, is the wrong way to go. Thomas Crowther, do you have the science now to prove that's true?
We undoubtedly do. Once again, with this global scale approach, we can see past the idiosyncrasy of individual site analyses. So there have been lots of studies saying, you know, a more diverse forest is better or a monoculture is better in different parts of the world. But by taking data from every single, all these millions of locations around the world, we can get a global unifying perspective. And what we find is consistently at a global scale, more species is always better than fewer species. We in fact did a back of the envelope scaling in one of our recent papers to show that the global forests are worth just over $600 billion to the timber market and the pulp and paper industry and forestry. If we were to instead convert the world's forests to a monoculture of the most productive forests, those forests, even with the same number of trees in those forests, if it was just a monoculture, would lose almost $300 billion just to the timber market. It's a massive difference. And so undoubtedly, diversity of species is always better.
So monoculture is just it's a bad business decision.
Undoubtedly. It's a bad business decision, and for the ecology of these ecosystems, it's a devastating one because we know that diversity provides such services to support all other parts of life, which also then supports human life. They capture less carbon, so the monocultures aren't as good at offsetting climate change. So in almost all circumstances, diversity is much better than a monoculture.
And we talked about the soil initiative. What is the Global Forest Biodiversity Initiative?
So this is a huge network of data collection that we've started in our lab, very similar to the Soil Biodiversity Initiative data set, where instead of relying on satellites alone, we can now connect all the thousands of foresters around the world who are generating incredibly good and detailed information on the ground. They've been in those forests, they've measured those trees, they've evaluated the health of those ecosystems. And by sending in all of that data, we can combine all that information at a global scale. Then using machine learning and artificial intelligence, again, we can get that really good predictive understanding of the structure of forests that's built from bottom-up data rather than satellites.
When I watch a couple of your YouTube video presentations, I'm stunned by the brand new maps of where things grow on our planet or life we've never seen hidden underground. And I expect experts to use GIS or geographic information systems to communicate complex results so we can all understand them. But it seems to me you've gone another step. You use those maps as tools of discovery to find new things. Is that true?
That's exactly true. By combining these huge data sets of information, not only do we reveal where ecosystems can store more carbon or less carbon or more biodiversity, but we also just learn fundamental new things about the planet that we couldn't have known from taking a local scale approach, like how many trees exist on the planet or the fact that there's more carbon in the high latitudes than the low latitudes. And every time we combine this global scale information, we get completely new insights into our biosphere. And it's only with that kind of understanding that we can be really effective in our fight against climate change.
Do you see a time coming when the public will be able to use your interactive maps to zoom into our own home regions to see what grows or what could grow where we live?
Definitely. That time is very soon. With geographic information systems, and in fact, Google Earth Engine is an incredibly useful tool that can be used to take those maps and place them onto systems that can be easily used by people at home. And in fact, we're starting to do that now. So all of our maps, as soon as they're published, they're going to be uploaded and available. So you can click onto your Google Maps and you can actually zoom around the world and go, how many trees are there here? How many trees could there be here in the absence of humans? And how much carbon could they support? And the nice thing is, you know, I've been doing it myself in the last couple of days. The first thing you do is you zoom in on your home and you go, oh, how many trees should there be here? Whoa, there should be loads. Okay, cool. This place can support a lot of forest. And just that spatial perspective, I hope it's going to inspire people to really get engaged and feel connected to the planet.
Thomas Crowther, I last talked with you in December 2016 after you published your paper quantifying global soil carbon losses in response to warming, and that was in the journal Nature. Do you have any new surprises that have developed from your research since then?
I have to say that every time we get one of these global perspectives, it's a bit of a new surprise. At the moment, we have four papers that are currently under review that are really going to transform our understanding of the distribution of biodiversity and carbon storage in the biosphere. But until they come out, I can't quite give you the exact numbers. So hopefully in the very near future, I'll be able to provide all of that information to you, and hopefully people can use it to make effective climate change decisions.
Well, I'll be watching my Science Alert service, and then I can pass it on to listeners when your papers come out. And as a final question, Thomas, you've developed some answers about the world we didn't have before, and I'd love to ask you what it is that sparks this blast of science in your head, but I also suspect maybe that's one of the few things you don't know for sure. Your thoughts?
I think you may well be right. I've always been inspired by diversity. Anyone who says there's no magic in the world, I just challenge them to look outside the window and look at the immense biodiversity that scientists have no meaningful explanation for. We don't know how life arose, let alone is maintained. And this has always just inspired me. But I think the recent developments in our research are partially due to that inspiration by biodiversity, but also a lot of luck. We've come here, well, I'm starting to do this at a time when data is available. We can finally start to get this global scale perspective. And so every new piece of information seems to unlock new pieces of information. And I think it's just an incredibly exciting time to be involved in this.
I'll let you go now. Thomas, thank you for your work and for sharing it with us on Radio EcoShock.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Great to chat to you.
From ETH Zurich in Switzerland, we spoke with Dr. Thomas Crowther. Find links to the science we discussed, a couple of videos with his amazing computer-driven maps, and the links to the Crowther Lab in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Next up, some surprises from the scientist who first warned us about Arctic methane, where it's coming from now, and why this little publicized gas could derail the Paris Agreement aimed at saving a livable climate. From ETH Zurich in Switzerland, we spoke with Dr. Thomas Crowther. Find links to the science we discussed, a couple of videos with his amazing computer-driven maps, and the links to the Crowther Lab in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Next up, some surprises from the scientist who first warned us about Arctic methane, where it's coming from now, and why this little publicized gas could derail the Paris Agreement, aimed at saving a livable climate.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Levels of the strong warming gas methane are again rising in the atmosphere. A new study warns the trend could derail plans made at Paris to contain climate change if things continue. Is the new surge of methane coming from the Arctic? Is it from fracking and natural gas pipelines? Guess again. Our next guest investigated the new mystery methane surge. Professor Ewan Nisbet is a professor of earth sciences at the Royal Holloway, University of London. On February 5, 2019, the AGU published the paper, Very Strong Atmospheric Methane Growth in the 4 years 2014-2017, Implications for the Paris Agreement. The lead author is Ewan Nisbet. Dr. Nisbet, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
You too. Now, for the public, global warming is about carbon dioxide. And for years, experts said methane doesn't really matter because it's a short-lived gas. What do you say?
Well, lots of things are important, as apples and oranges. Methane is actually very important indeed. You can rate it various different ways because it depends on the timescale, but it's nearly half as important, well, depending on how you count it, maybe in some countings more than half as important as CO2. The other thing is, in some ways, you can actually get at methane much more easily rather than changing the entire world economy, which we have to do for CO2, which we have to do. We need to do everything on CO2, but we mustn't forget the Cinderella gas, which is methane. And there's another one also, N2O, plus some others. So the other gases are also very, very, very important.
And for background, what was the level of methane in the atmosphere before the Industrial Revolution in the 1700s?
Well, first of all, don't really talk about levels, not a bucket of water. The amount, or it's called methane burden, or in chemistry we talk about the mole fraction. It's now around about, if you have a billion liters of air, you'll have around about 1,900 of those will be methane. Before the Industrial Revolution, 1,000 or below. And way, way back in the Ice Ages, it would be 300-400s. So we've pushed it up a very long way, proportionately much further than CO2.
And when I started this radio program in 2006, scientists told us methane, the burden in the atmosphere, was either paused or growing very slowly. When did the new growth start?
Okay, well, I'll wind you back a bit. For the last 200 years, it's been going up. And we know, because of the types of carbon in it, that it's been fossil fuels driving it up. And especially in the 1980s, when it was going up like crazy, particularly when the Russians were putting in their very large gas industry. And it looked as if it was equilibrating around about 2000. And from 2000 to 2006, it was going up and down, but basically fairly stable. We thought that the sources equaled the sinks. And so although methane was very, very high, it's like you're driving down the highway at 180 miles an hour, but you're not actually accelerating anymore. And then in 2007, something very strange happened, and methane started growing again pretty strongly. And then in 2014, it just went back to the growth rates of back in the 1980s. But the difference is the types of carbon-12, carbon-13 ratio in it was indicating that it wasn't necessarily fossil fuels that are doing this. It was something else. It was biological processes.
Well, let's get to a key question. How can scientists measure methane in the atmosphere and then know the source of it?
It's tough. The answer is no, we don't. What we do, particularly the American NOAA network, we have a network of stations around the world where there are a few instruments that record all the time, but people collect flasks of air. And so we're tracking CO2 and methane and the other gases from these flasks, particularly the American network. We also have a UK network that we run, and there are other ones in New Zealand. And Canada's got a very good network across Canada, Environment Canada. So that's telling you where it's growing, and so you'll see that it's growing faster, say, in the tropics than the Arctic, things like that. But then also we analyze the methane. Methane is CH4, and carbon comes in carbon-12 and carbon-13, and there's also radioactive carbon-14. And if you analyze those different types, the methane from geological sources and also from fires, so from coal and gas and from fires, that tends to be richer in carbon-13, relatively richer, whereas methane that comes from a swamp or a wetland or a landfill or a sewage plant or a cow, that tends to be somewhat richer in carbon-12. So if you analyze what's happening to the carbon-12-13 ratio, you can then figure out who's actually driving the increase, and also, of course, what the proportions are of the various gas, various sources.
And your team recently returned from Africa with new samples. Tell us about that expedition.
Well, there's back history here. Very long ago, in the 1980s, I worked in Saskatoon for a long time. My family's half from the prairies. And I was the one who actually suggested that methane in the Arctic was rising because of methane hydrates. It's long ago. And we've been watching the Arctic and doing a lot of work in the Arctic. But the bulk of the rise, apart from 2007, in the last 10 years, has been led from the tropics. Something was happening in the tropics we didn't understand. We have a wonderful aircraft that we had been flying around in the Arctic. It's the UK Atmospheric Research Aircraft. And so we've been flying that over African wetlands in collaboration with the Ugandan Meteorological Authority and also the Zambian Ministry of Mines and Geological Survey in Zambia, looking at these very big wetlands in Central Africa, because we think that a lot of the growth is happening in the tropics, in the wet tropics, and that may be coming from wetlands or it may be coming from cows or some other process. A cow is essentially a walking wetland. In terms of biology, it's pretty much the same. And we're trying to figure out just how much is coming off there. We're also working, ironically, in conjunction with the British Antarctic Survey, who have aircraft that, when they fly north up to service them in Calgary, the Twin Otters, they're going to be stopping in Bolivia and working with the physics department in La Paz to try to look at Bolivian emissions and emissions in the wetlands of South America. So we're trying to figure out what's actually happening in the tropics with the methane budget. And there's very little work on it so far.
Well, as you say, we've heard so much about methane from the Arctic and from natural gas systems. Most of us have never seen a tropical peat bog, and we have no idea how they operate. Can you describe the landscape that is releasing more methane?
Yeah, well, it's pretty complex. I've done huge amounts of work in the Arctic, and Arctic bogs are active for about sort of 6-8 weeks in the summer when they get hot. In the tropics, the intertropical convergence zone, which is also the monsoon in Asia, it sweeps north and south. Right now, it's down in Zambia, and then it sweeps back up to north of Nigeria, and it'll be up there in July, August, later on in the year, and crosses, of course, places the equatorial parts twice, like Uganda. So Uganda's pretty wet, and Zambia's got these enormous wetlands. And also around there, lots of cows, and there's lots of biomass burning as well, people burning fires and crop and so on. And all of these processes are making methane. Anytime you get a swamp, you get rotting vegetation, it becomes anaerobic. And then you get microbes, they're called archaea, methanogenic archaea. They make methane, the sort of bottom end of the breakdown stage. And you also get pretty much the same thing going on inside a cow's tummy. And out of that comes this gas methane. A lot of it, as it comes up through the water or wherever it is, gets reoxidized by bacteria called methanotrophs. So that just gets turned into CO2. But a lot of it gets into the air. And for example, in our flights recently, they were flying over Lake Bangweulu, which is a big lake in Zambia. It's actually where David Livingstone died. And means where the water sky meets the sky. It's wonderful, wonderful photos. And they found a huge plume of methane coming off that. They're Bangweulu wetlands. They're just pouring out methane.
Do we have any idea what would stimulate more methane coming from the tropics starting around 2007?
Well, climate change, this looks like the warming feeding the warming. I've got to be careful because there are other explanations too. But the tropics are getting more active. They're getting wetter, warmer, and expanding. The rainfall tropics, the meteorological tropics. You know, the line around the Earth stays pretty much the same. But the belt of rainfall that moves north and south is getting warmer and wetter and stronger. And if you add an awful lot of water on a bit of flat ground, you're going to get a big lot of wetland and lots of, in Africa, it's papyrus, papyrus swamps. And that's something called a C4 plant. It grows like crazy. If you've ever seen paper, paper comes from papyrus. Originally. And these are very, very productive wetlands. And around them, of course, more rain, you get more grass, you get more cows. Population growth is extremely high in these areas. The populations are, it's one of the area where the population growth is fastest around the world. So lots of human population going up as well. And they, they've got more cows and more of this, that, and the other. And they're also throwing fertilizer on the ground now. So everything is going up, and the result is an awful lot more rotting vegetation in the wetlands, and the wetlands getting wetter, and lots more cows, everything. And also lots more fires burning the crop waste and goodness knows what. All these things are making methane. And more sewage from people, too.
Ewan, how do you know the growing levels of methane are not simply due to a change in atmospheric chemistry, which gives methane perhaps a longer lifetime or something that would bring higher levels without any increase on the ground?
Well, that's part of our big discussion we're having at the moment, and in particular this group in Harvard and Caltech who've been suggesting this, because along with climate change and all the various things we're throwing in the atmosphere, we run the risk of changing the cleaning power of the atmosphere. If you imagine water, H2O, well, HOH, if you knock off an H with reactions to do with light and oxygen, you'll get OH, and that's called the policeman of the atmosphere. The OH is what oxidizes all the bad species, all the pollutants, plus methane isn't strictly a pollutant. It's a natural greenhouse gas, but it oxidizes methane to carbon dioxide, which has far less warming impact per unit than methane does. So if you do something to change the OH, you're basically shooting the policeman. And that means that the methane will increase, the methane burden will increase. And it's possible that the OH in the atmosphere, particularly in certain areas where pollution from other gases is bad, that may have been declining. And therefore the methane would go up because there's less policemen to catch the bad guys.
As you know, there's almost a competition for other ideas for the sources of the new methane growth. What about the increasing super wildfires in recent years as the planet heats up?
Now, this is where the carbon isotopes come in. Yeah, wildfires could be happening. Actually, in the last few years, there's some evidence suggesting actually the amount of wildfires in the tropics is declining rather than increasing. But that varies quite a lot. Now, the methane that comes from fires tends to be relatively rich in carbon-13. And there's a discussion, a suggestion from John Worden in NASA JPL. He suggested that actually methane from natural gas leaks is increasing, but because the fires have been decreasing, it's sort of hiding the isotopic effect on the carbon-12-13 ratio. And so maybe fires have been decreasing, but emissions from gas leaks and so on have been increasing, and that could be part of the cause as well. Now, all of these things that are driving the methane budget, they're not exclusive. They could all be happening, and the question is working out the proportion. And for that, we use what are called inverse models. You take all the measurements you've got around the world, and then you take all the isotopes as well, and then you do a giant mathematical model, but you've got to add in the winds and the fact that the methane gets blown from A to B. And so it's pretty complicated computing. And you can try to figure out where the source areas are, what's putting what in. But it's a tough one.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. As always, I'm your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Ewan Nisbet, Professor of Earth Sciences at Royal Holloway in London. We're talking about a new surge of methane as dangerous warming gas into the atmosphere. Scientists tell us carbon dioxide tends to become evenly distributed in the global atmosphere. Is that true of methane? And if not, can localized methane drive localized warming?
Methane mixes across the planet in about a year. If you actually look at where methane is, there's sort of waterfall on the hemispheric boundary, which is the intertropical convergence. It's significantly higher in the northern hemisphere. The methane death zone is where OH is strongest, and that's in the moist air where the sun is very bright, and that's in the tropical belt where the sun's vertical in daytime. So methane blows southwards. The southern hemisphere sources as well, but the overwhelming sources are in the northern hemisphere. CO2 mixes as well. In terms of local regions, yes, the methane mixes. The bigger impacts locally are, of course, air pollution. For example, China and India live under a very, very heavy haze, if you've ever been to Beijing in November. And increasingly now, heavily populated parts of Africa also, particularly in the dry season, very, very strong burning. So that's actually probably got a big impact on local temperatures. And then we've a huge amount of deforestation going on. Not entirely. Some areas are actually growing forest. And that changes local temperature as well. So all these factors are going on. So each local area has got its own particular factors happening to warm it, or if it's heavily under a burden of horrendous pollution, it might cool it, depending on what's happening locally.
You were very interested in methane coming out of the Arctic, and we do have a lot of warnings that perhaps clathrates, that the frozen methane under shallow seabeds might thaw and emit more methane. Should we take our eyes off the Arctic now that we know that the tropics are the source of the new increase?
No. If you're in a boxing match and somebody's hitting you upwards, you don't take your eyes off the other hand. No, I was actually the person who suggested that a long time ago in the 80s when I worked in Saskatoon. And we have found a while ago evidence, strong evidence, for example, off Spitsbergen of plumes of methane coming up in several hundred meters of water. Now, the nice thing is that that methane is released into the water, or in the permafrost, it's coming up through the permafrost, but it gets picked up by methanotrophic bacteria. It's food for them. They take the methane and essentially convert it to CO2 and make a living out of that. So essentially, they're doing what you do when you burn gas. And between them and dissolution in the water, they're pretty efficient. So it gets up through 100 meters of water or so, but we get five flasks a week from Spitsbergen. These are air flasks, because we're watching for exactly that. And as far as we can tell, the Arctic is not releasing significant amounts of methane from hydrates at the moment. There may be burps from particular sources occasionally, but if you look in the Arctic, in the summer, the methane comes from the Arctic wetlands. The isotopes are pretty clear on that. In the winter, the main sources seem to be the gas fields. Russia's, some of the world's biggest gas fields are in the Siberian Arctic. And you can measure, say, in Spitsbergen, and then track the air back to where it last touched ground, and that'll be in over the gas fields. So we think at the moment the Arctic is not leading the world in methane growth. In 2007, there was a period where there was strong growth. That appeared probably to be in air that was blown from very warm boreal regions, northern Canada, northern Siberia, up into the high Arctic. So right now the Arctic is not at the top of our worry list, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't look at it. It's very important we look at it. Canada's got a very important station at ALERT, which is measuring the air. Norway measures in Spitsbergen, Americans in Barrow, and there's a station run with the Russians and the Finns at a place called Tixi. So there is a bit of watching in the Arctic. We get flasks from ALERT and from Spitsbergen, and we're watching it pretty carefully. But right now, the concern is actually in the tropics.
Well, I'm glad to hear there's eyes on up there. So let's say the current trend of biogenic emissions continues. Why do you say that could affect the Paris Climate Agreement?
We think it's probably biogenic, but it could also be all these other factors as well. Whatever it is, methane is going up fast. Now, essentially, the Paris Agreement allows you a certain amount of warming. The agreement was either 1.5 or 2 degrees. And that translates into so much emission. It's not very much of CO2 and CH4 before we hit our limit. How do you get there? One way of getting there is to, which was really thought of in the scenarios that led to the Paris Agreement, was that we can probably get methane under some degree of control, because a significant proportion of the methane comes from the natural gas and coal industries, and that's relatively easy to reduce. So if we do that, that gives us a little bit more time to basically change the world's economy and get CO2 emissions under control. However, if methane is rocketing up, that leaves you far less sort of carbon dioxide space if you're going to hit the Paris target. And it's going up so much that the sort of emission space that we've got before 2100 is getting quite significantly less than was thought of when everyone signed the Paris Agreement. So it threatens the Paris Agreement quite badly.
Well, obviously, we could cut emissions that are leaking out of our pipelines and fracking pads and all that sort of thing and change over to renewables. But is there anything we humans can do to reduce the new surge of methane coming from the tropics and the southern hemisphere?
Complex. The first thing to do is exactly what you said. Cut the natural gas emissions and the coal emissions. And actually, the frackers, the recent work on the frackers, have been pretty good. Some of the early work by NOAA, by people like Anna Carrion and Gabby Petron, showed that the frackers were losing, say, 9% of their gas just to air. Nowadays, the more recent work has shown that they've cut those leaks very significantly, and in some fracking areas, the leaks have come down enormously, probably because that's profit. If you leak gas, that's profit. But there's still huge losses from the gas industry and from the coal industry. The good side is that our ability to detect where emissions are coming from is very much better than it used to be. For big leaks, you can put sensors on drones and so on. For small leaks, all you do is you drive around with an instrument and you can locate the leak pretty well. Once you know where the leak is, stopping it is a no-brainer. That's also true of gas distribution leaks in urban areas. We drive around London and we pick up all the leaks. If only we can just persuade the industry to stop those leaks, it would take a huge amount out. Coal mines, another one. We really need to do something about it. Now, in the tropics, different problem. First of all, the cow part of it, which is pretty significant, there's discussion about how much of it, but it's quite a lot. The cow superpowers are countries like India, Ethiopia, Brazil, South Sudan, where a cow is a very major part of the culture. And trying to reduce that is quite complex. Trying to persuade Westerners to eat a bit less meat, that's okay. But you've got to be careful, because if you, for example, replace an organic cow on a pasture in Scotland with something intensively grown agriculture somewhere in the tropics, which you've now imported or some whatever, you're not necessarily winning in greenhouse terms. So it's a pretty complex argument. But we could certainly reduce the agricultural emissions and do a lot more to do that. It's not as easy as reducing the gas industry, but it helps. With the wetlands, not much, except try to be careful about letting fertilizers run into them, but I suspect that's not possible. What we could do, though, is reduce some of the biomass burning in the tropics, particularly as that's also a major cause of air pollution. And it exports agricultural soil nutrients to the air and eventually to the oceans. Africa's fires are feeding the fish in the Atlantic and actually feeding Amazonia eventually.
I did not know that. Another exciting new fact from science.
Burn your plant and it goes up in the air and all the nutrients go with it. Got to land somewhere. And in Africa particularly, they burn like crazy. I'm Zimbabwean, as you probably got from my accent. So, sorry, Zimbabwean Canadian, it's a mess. So I grew up with these fires, and in Harare in July, August, you choke. Well, it depends on the year, but some years.
We're choking here now in July and August, but it's due to wildfires. We've had wildfire emergencies every year for the last 3 years.
I spent a lot of time as a geologist mapping in northern Canada, so I know those fires. Scary sometimes, too.
So this steep curve of atmospheric methane isn't happening in isolation from other steep curves for both carbon dioxide and global temperatures. In that scenario, is it possible we could experience a burst of extra heating in part due to a methane spike?
Well, I wouldn't call it a spike. We don't know where it's going. We know the upside. We don't know if there's a downside on it. a spike implies a downside. Yeah, it's pretty worrying. If it carries on growing at the current rate, we're in pretty serious trouble. Now, I shouldn't be entirely doom and gloom. We do have one very, very good story, which is the banning of the chlorofluorocarbons through the Montreal Protocol. And that primarily was done by Margaret Thatcher, who sat down and read the science and then persuaded George Bush the First that this was really, really important. But she was an excellent chemist, and so she read the scientific papers, I'm told. And the CFCs, apart from saving the ozone, and if they hadn't done that, by now the ozone problems worldwide would be very, very serious indeed, affecting an awful lot of life, including plant life and early crops. But as well as doing that, the CFCs are very powerful greenhouse gases. And one of the most effective actions we've ever taken on the greenhouse was to ban the CFCs. That was a huge and effective action. We can do the same sort of thing with methane, really trying to reduce gas leaks, coal mine emissions.
I remember, too, James Hansen and George Bush II came out with the methane control program, which included trying to harvest it from dumps and landfills, and they had a whole program to do that.
No, actually, to be fair, in Europe and North America, landfills now, we do a lot of work around landfills, are emitting far, far less than they used to. But what has surprised me is the extent recently of landfills in the tropics. When I was a child in Africa, all of our rubbish went in a hole in the ground, and we threw some ash on it, but basically it got oxidized. It didn't produce, it was just in the backyard, really. Nowadays, all over the tropics, there's some very big cities with very big open landfills, and very often these landfills are on fire as well, and they're an obvious thing to do something about. Simplest thing you need to do is just put some soil on it, and then the methanotrophic bacteria will have a habitat, and they'll eat the methane coming off. You know, that's very simple technology. Most landfills in Europe are very heavily piped and instrumented, and then you take off the methane and you make electricity with that at stage two. And that's quite doable with tropical landfills also, and we need to be doing that. So I would put landfills as pretty high on my list, tropical landfills, for mitigation efforts, because right now they're just heaps.
You and Nisbet, we're pretty close to our time here, but what are your next steps for your research here?
Pretty complicated. I'd like to do a lot more work on the isotopes in the tropics to figure out what the signatures of the emissions are. I also have a long-term pet project, which has spent years trying to get going, to put a decent observatory on Ascension Island in the central Atlantic. We have Mauna Loa, which is essential in the Pacific. But in the Atlantic, in the remote Atlantic, we have flasks from Ascension Island, but we don't actually have sort of continuous, steady measurement of lots and lots of gases. And it's an ideal site.
From the UK, we've been speaking with Dr. Ewan Nisbet, Professor of Earth Sciences at the Royal Holloway, University of London. You can find links to his team's paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ewan, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been fun talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening this week. Don't forget to follow up with my show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Please support your local nonprofit radio station, Radio EcoShock, and pass the word on to your contacts on social media. It all helps. Thank you for caring about our world.